This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. That's the sound of the San Quentin prison door slamming as our guest Earlonne Woods was released in late November after being incarcerated there for 7 years. The sound was recorded because he's the co-host and co-producer of the podcast Ear Hustle, which features interviews with San Quentin inmates talking about daily life there. Things like living with a cellmate in a tiny cell, what it's like to be in solitary confinement, the heartbreak of being a parent separated from your child, and how everything inside is separated by race. The podcast title, Ear Hustle, is prison slang for eavesdropping or being nosy. Woods was convicted of attempted second-degree robbery, but because of the three strikes law, was sentenced to 31 years to life, most of which were served in prisons other than San Quentin. Governor Jerry Brown commuted his sentence in November, and Woods regained his freedom after serving 21 years. Also with us is Nigel Poor. She co-created the podcast with Woods and has co-hosted and co-produced it with him. Poor is a professor of photography at California State University in Sacramento. She first started working in San Quentin in 2011 as a volunteer in the Prison University Project teaching the history of photography. Before creating the podcast, Woods and Poor did interviews with inmates in San Quentin for public radio station KALW in San Francisco. Terry Gross spoke to Earlonne Woods and Nigel Poor last Wednesday.
Earlonne Woods, Nigel Poor, welcome to Fresh Air. Earlonne, congratulations on life outside of prison. So before we talk about the podcast and before we talk about your work together, Earlonne, I want to talk with you about life outside. So let me ask you about ways you think you've changed since you were a teenager and were first put in prison, and you've had two separate stays, and the last one lasted 21 years. Right. So you're a middle-aged man now. So what are some of the ways?
47 years old.
Yeah. What are some of the ways you think you've changed over the years?
Well, I think so. I'll say this: my first prison term, I went to jail when I was 17, and I was paroled when I was 23, about to turn 24. And prison was more like, oh, hey, this is a place to go and continue your gang activity, continue your destructive behavior. And that's pretty much what I did. I went in and ended up in the security housing unit a couple of times for lengthy stays and just continued my pretty much destructive behavior all the way out. And then when I got out, I hadn't put any skill sets together, you know, so I still had a 17-year-old mentality. I got out, stayed out 2 years, 10 months, and found myself back in jail for attempted second-degree robbery. And this time, they had something for me, which was the three-strike law. They said that, hey, when you went to jail when you were 17, yeah, it was one time, but there was two convictions in that case, so we're going to strike you out this time. And I received 31 years to life. And when I went in the second time, my friend Furman Little was killed the night we were arrested. The responding officers shot him 5 times, killed him. And my whole thinking like changed in that moment. It was like a light switch, like what was all this for? Like, why were we on this path, you know? So for me, internally, I started my change. Like in the county jail, I was like, okay, I'm done with this side of life because even though our philosophy growing up was for death though, you know, meaning I'd rather be carried by 6 than judged by 12. That was just a philosophy we had growing up, you know, and
That means like you'd rather die than be.
I'd rather die than go to jail.
In prison? Uh-huh.
Yes, yes. And when it actually happened, it was an awakening in me, like, oh man, why is we living this way? You know, why are we living like we don't care? Because this is somehow how we grew up, and how since as an early teenager we've been living in the streets, in the gangs. Everybody we know live the same lifestyle. And when I was sitting in a county jail, you know, mentally I pretty much divorced myself from that whole way of life. In that moment, you know, like I just walked away, you know, and as time went on, as years went on, I stuck to my guns. I was just done. I think maybe 14 years in my sentence, I went to San Quentin. And I got into this group. It was a restorative justice group. And we used to do like healing circles. And it really wasn't until I got into the healing circle that I understood what it was like to be a survivor of crime. Because in these circles, you're sitting across from crime victims. You're sitting across from politicians. You're sitting across from law enforcement. And y'all having these intimate conversations about, you know, why you went down this path or what it was like being a survivor. And you really get a better understanding of your impact that you've personally had on people in society. And it was one of them, I guess you could say, moments where you just feel embarrassed about your previous conduct. Even though you can't do nothing about your past, you just feel embarrassed about even going down that route, even victimizing anybody. So
give us an example of somebody who you spoke to who had been a victim of a crime similar to the one that you committed that made you feel this, you know, sense of feeling bad for what you'd done.
So I'll give you an example. There's a lady, her name was Claire, and it was one of the Restore Justice symposiums, it was transformational symposiums, and her son had attended a party. He had just became a paramedic or something, and he's standing in a group. They're waiting to get inside a club, and somebody from way across the street just shoot into the crowd, hit him in the heart, right? And just listening to her tell her story to us, and knowing that I've been in these type of situations, or knowing that I've been probably on the other side of the gun or whatever the case may be, and just hearing her loss, hearing her heartfelt testimony about this was really, it was shaking it, you know? It's not just her, it was other people telling, you know, their stories about being robbed or losing a child, losing a loved one, and it just puts you in a whole different space, you know? It mentally puts you in a whole different space.
So can I ask you an honest question? What's it like to not think about that? What's it like to not care about the person who you're robbing or the person who might be killed by a stray bullet? In some ways, like, I find it hard to understand that somebody, like, wouldn't have any empathy for the victim and wouldn't care.
I think the mentality is more of crime to you is a job. The victims of a crime are faceless. You're not really looking at the person. You're more looking at what you're getting out of the situation. Like me personally, what I took away from a lot of things is that, yeah, I may have robbed a person for, let's say, $1, but I took way more from that person than $1. I took their security from them to even walk out the house and feel safe. You know, and when you're in that moment, I think it's more of crime to people in society that commit crime is a job.
A job because you thought it was like your only source of income?
Well, me growing up the way I grew up, I grew up in a lifestyle where I was young when I got into selling drugs, and I was real young. I probably was like 14. And then I got into the lifestyle of robbing drug dealers, and that's the only way of life that you're accustomed to, because that's all you see. And it's all that some of the people that you choose to associate with do, you know? So you become accustomed to that lifestyle. And I think I didn't become accustomed to the lifestyle of working or having a job, you know? And many people around me wasn't like that. So I think I did what pretty much my community did that was around me.
Nigel, let me bring you into the conversation. Mm-hmm. Nigel, when you decided you wanted to start like a interview series that started mm-hmm. on KALW, one of the public radio stations in San Francisco, and then it became a podcast, you wanted a co-host and co-producer who was incarcerated in San Quentin, and you chose Erlon. And you've said in the past that he was always the quietest person in the room, but you could tell he was a good observer. So what were the first communications like in which you tried to see, well, but is he a good interviewer? Is he a good talker? Is he a good co-host?
Yeah. Well, He wasn't necessarily a good talker because he was very quiet. I'm always interested in people who, I'm quiet myself, I'm pretty shy, and I'm always interested in people who kind of fade into the background a little bit because I suspect they could be the most interesting people in the room. And I observed Erlon a lot. Yes, he was quiet, but he was always present and he was always ready to help. And the thing that I noticed in particular about him was that whenever there was an issue going on, and of course inside prison there's all kinds of issues, and if we would have to sit down to solve a problem, Erlon was the one who would speak up, cut through all of the baloney, and get to the point. And so to me that meant he was a very good observer. He understood human nature, and he understood how to diffuse a situation. And I thought, well, those are kind of qualities that you need to be able to bring people out. And so we just started talking, and I realized that he was interested in thinking about how we could do interviews from more of an artistic perspective, not as journalist. I realized that he had a really intense work ethic that matched my own, and that we just really got along. I felt like in Erlon I found a true professional colleague. It just turned out that he was incarcerated. So,
Nigel, I want to play an excerpt of an episode that you were very prominent in. And I'm playing this because it's about knowing where the line is when you're interviewing prisoners, and sometimes to have to ask something that's going to make them uncomfortable. There's a story you did about how people like you from the outside who come in to volunteer, because you started at San Quentin volunteering, teaching photography before you started doing the podcast Ear Hustle. So there's a rule that pertains to the volunteers who come in, and they're not allowed to have like close relationships with the prisoners. Anything that gets really intimate or emotional, and I'm not even talking about physically intimate, but just emotionally intimate, is against regulations. But apparently it's fine. Like if you fall in love, the prisoner and the volunteer fall in love, that's fine as long as the volunteer or the staff person is no longer going to be working there in any capacity. So you're interviewing a prisoner who he and one of the volunteers fell in love, and so she stopped working there in any capacity, and they got married. Eventually, the marriage fell apart. Mm-hmm. But after you recorded that interview, you found out something about him and decided, like, you could not play that interview unless you asked him another question. And so I want to play the part where you return to ask him that difficult question. So here's Nigel Poor, co-host and co-producer of the podcast Ear Hustle.
There's something I have to talk to you about.
Okay.
And it's going to be a little bit hard.
Okay.
So I'm just going to be very blunt with you. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So we do stories about life inside prison. We don't really do stories about people's crimes at all. And so I found out what you're in prison for. I was hoping I could talk to you a little bit about it. How do we tell stories and leave out that part?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I try to be like open and honest about my past and the things that I've done, including what I've done to get to prison. I don't know. I think the scope of the number of people that could possibly listen to this, I'm just really nervous about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
While you're thinking, can I tell you some of the things that are just going through my mind about it? And it might help you?
Absolutely.
So one of the things is that I really believe that people change. Like, I take you as the man you are in front of me, and I listen very carefully to how you talked about your relationship and how much you thought about it and how painful and joyous the whole experience was for you. And so when people listen to the story, that's what I want them to take away, that here's this person who's in a difficult situation. They eventually met this person. They fell in love just like anyone else would. It didn't work out, unfortunately. You end thinking, like, here's this guy who's very self-actualized. And then what worries me is, like, so people will leave with this very, like, skewed, I love this guy.
Skewed view
I love
of
this,
things.
Yeah, not skewed. But then someone will research you and be like, did they just feed me a bunch of bull? But if we could just talk about it and come to some understanding about what's our responsibility, what's your responsibility. So I'm trying to partner with you here. How do we present this?
You guys are killing me. Here you guys are, poking and prodding.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you feel like we're being unfair trying to make you do this?
No, I don't feel you're being unfair at all, and I don't ultimately know what my hesitancy is. So on December 7th, 1994, I murdered my ex-girlfriend, the mother of my now 25-year-old daughter.
And Nigel, just as a person who's constantly interacting with inmates at San Quentin, do you want to know what they're incarcerated for, what crime they were convicted of, or would you just as soon not know and just judge them based on what they present to you and their interactions with you?
I don't ask unless it comes up as part of the story. I'd rather not know. I'd rather deal with anyone actually as they are in front of me at that moment. But the things that you do in your past do add dimension to who you are in this moment. So sometimes it's important, and I can give you an example. There's a man that I worked with for quite a while that I was very fond of, and at one point he revealed to me that he had raped quite a few women. And it was very hard for that to not change the way I felt about him. I had to really work through it and think about it. And he said the thing that all women fear is that I raped women because I could. And to hear, like, to take that in and to not be afraid and to not judge a person, but to just like, sit with it and think about this was 30 years ago. Like, I had to do a lot of work around that. And it's fine. I'm fine working with him now, but that was a case that challenged my desire to not know and to how to deal with the knowing once it's been presented to you. So in that case, I didn't dig in. That was something that was volunteered to me.
Erlon, what's the custom among men in San Quentin? Do you usually know what somebody is in for, and do you ask, or is that considered wrong to ask?
So I think that goes into like what they call politics in prison, and where, you know, you may have certain prisons that it matters what you're in prison for, like, and it's a difference on the race level. Like, you may have guys that are Hispanics or whites who, when they get to a certain prison, their race is like, let me see your paperwork, let me see why you're here. But you may have the African Americans who go to prison and they at certain places, and you don't get that question. So I think far as the African-American culture in prison, I don't think nobody really cares why you're in prison.
Can I ask how your relationship is changing now that you're both outside?
Well, I can let Erlon answer that one.
Well, I mean, it's cool, you know. I go over to Nigel's house, hang out with her husband, Rick. He spins his vinyl. He got a hell of a collection of vinyl.
We're able to share food.
Yeah,
we can taste each other's food, because, you know, in prison you can't share food with people. You have to wear the same clothes all the time. There's all these restrictions. So now we're friends and we're colleagues. And
of course, I enjoy all the little moments. I was going to Nigel's house the other day, and I was an hour early, and I stopped by this lake. I don't know if it's a lake. It's something.
It's the bay. Yeah, the bay.
The bay. I just stopped over there, went and sat on a rock and just watched the water for about an hour. It was so kickback and
peaceful.
Cool, meaning I take advantage of all these moments now. I don't take them for granted. I enjoy every second of every day.
And the other thing is we've tried to always keep this as equal as possible. But of course, when someone's in prison and the other person's not, there's so many things you can't do. So now we just have the opportunity to travel together, to do something like this together. Instead of me representing it, Erlon and I can represent it together. And one of my goals has been for us to travel to other prisons, and I never wanted to do that without Erlon. So now we can actually do that, and even hopefully go to other countries too.
I want to thank you both so much. And Erlan, again, I want to congratulate you again for your new freedom. And Nigel, and Erlan, I want to wish you good luck with the retooled version of Air Hustle now that Erlan is out. I look forward to hearing
who
the new, as yet unannounced, host will be with you.
Yes. Very,
and Erlan, really I look forward to your interviews with people who, like you, are transitioning back into society from prison. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Terry Gross speaking with Erlan Woods and Nigel Poor about their podcast Ear Hustle, which features interviews with men incarcerated in San Quentin. Erlan Woods was released from San Quentin in November after his sentence was commuted by Governor Jerry Brown. Nigel Poor is a professor of photography at California State University in Sacramento. Two new interpretations of the complete works of Thelonious Monk have been released, arranged for jazz quartet and for solo guitar. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says both catch Monk's playful spirit.
Frank Kimbrough on a Monk tune Monk never recorded, Two-Timer. It's from the 6-CD set, Monk's Dreams, the complete compositions of Thelonious Sphere Monk. Something like it had been done before, very well too, when German pianist Alex von Schlippenbach and company recorded the creatively varied Monk's Casino in 2003, but they missed a few tunes. The new Monk's Dreams was recorded quickly in 7 sessions. Sometimes the quartet recalls Monk's own informal repertory project, re-recording his older classics in the 1960s. Saxophonist Scott Robinson has his own sound, but catches the clear way Monk's tenor Charlie Rouse enunciated those melodies. Compositions sounded like his piano. The same playful hesitations, clanky chords, and foregrounding of melody. To do justice to them, you might meet Monk halfway, the way Kimbrough does on piano. Rufus Reed on bass and drummer Billy Drummond swing the foundation the way Monk liked it. For extra gravitas, Scott Robinson sometimes mans the mighty contrabass sarrusophone or bass saxophone. This quartet has a good feel for the material. Their Monk marathon never feels like a slog. Scott Robinson also picks up trumpet a few times, and every so often the band take respectful liberties with a written line. This is Jackie. Tweak the melody there by playing the pitches as written with different timing. That's one tactic guitarist Miles Okazaki uses on his heroic solo take on all 70 Monk tunes, the downloadable album Work. One way or another, every piece addresses the same problem. How to adapt music designed for band or piano to solo guitar, an instrument with a much smaller range where it's harder to keep independent lines going. Harder, but not impossible. Thelonious Monk's theme, Epistrophe. Miles Okazaki recorded work over many months, giving each tune a fresh approach. Some of Monk's weird chords require retuning the guitar, but he also looks to the composer's intentions. Monk's Shuffle Boyle was inspired by the great Harlem tap dancers, so Okazaki taps out some traditional time steps on the strings. Miles Okazaki gets into the spirit of the material. Monk once recorded the ballad Pannonica using a keyboard that plays little bells. In tribute, Okazaki plays as much of the melody as he can in chiming harmonics. The ballads are among the highlights of Miles Okazaki's Monk epic. There are some fast numbers where the sound gets a little thin, where one frantic line seems not quite enough. But Okazaki, like Frank Kimbrough's foursome, rises to this formidable challenge. One reason to tackle all the Monk tunes is to play material you'd never engage otherwise. More than anything, these fine studies confirm Monk's genius as composer. He wrote dozens of instantly catchy works that sound like no one else could have dreamed them up.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed two collections of the complete compositions of Thelonious Monk, arranged for jazz quartet by Frank Kimbrough and for guitar by Miles Okazaki. Coming up, Terry talks with Henry Louis Gates. The fifth season of his TV series Finding Your Roots is now showing on PBS, and we'll hear what he's learned of his own ancestry. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Now we're going to listen to an interview Terry recorded with historian and documentary filmmaker Henry Louis Gates. The new season of his TV series, Finding Your Roots, is now showing on PBS. In the show, notable guests discover their family roots based on genealogical research and DNA results. This kind of research has been especially important for African Americans, whose ancestors had their names and families taken away when they were enslaved. One episode this season explores Gates' own DNA and family history. Professor Gates is the director of the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard and has produced numerous books and documentaries about African American history. Terry spoke to Henry Louis Gates in front of an audience last May when he was in Philadelphia to receive WHYY's annual Lifelong Learning Award.
Thank you.
Because you've talked to everybody about their genealogy, I want to talk with you about yours and what you've learned about yourself and the larger meaning of what you've learned about yourself. And I want to start with the person who got you started in genealogy. It was really like the photograph of her, of your great-great-aunt, Jane Gates. And you've
Great-great-grandma.
Great-great-grandma.
Yes,
I mean, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. So I want to read something that you wrote about her, and you got this from the 1870 census. Mm-hmm. That Jane Gates, age 51, female, mulatto, laundress, and nurse, owns real estate valued at $1,400, born in Maryland, cannot read or write. Now, she was born in 1819, mm-hmm. died in 1888. You were 9 years old when you found her picture.
Right.
And got this information from the 1870 census. So reading this, that she's a mulatto, she'd been a slave, the first question that comes to my mind, and I don't know if it was the first question that came to yours, was she raped by the man who owned her?
Mm-hmm. I can't believe you asked this question because...
Is that too personal? That's a horrible way to start in a way.
Well, the average African-American is 24% European. Now, think about that. And most DNA companies in the United States will tell you that they have never tested an African-American who was 100% from sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. This is called an admixture test. It measures your ancestry back 500 years, approximately. So what that means is that it's the percent of, if you had a perfect family tree, what percent would be from sub-Saharan Africa, what percent would be from Europe, what percent would be Native American. African-American, I love to joke about this, African-Americans all think that they're descended from a Native American, and the average African American has less than 1% Native American ancestry, but they have 24% European ancestry. So where does that come from? It comes from slavery. Was this an equal sexual relationship? Of course not. So obviously, rape, or at best cajoled sexuality, was the cause. But there are exceptions. When I did Morgan Freeman's family tree, it was obvious through his DNA that he was descended from a white man who was an overseer on a plantation in Mississippi. And we knew the name of his great-great-grandmother and the name of this white man. So overseer, slave, plantation, rape, right? Except in the next scene, I showed him their headstones. They were buried next to each other. As soon as the Civil War ended, they became common law husband and wife, wow, which was illegal in Mississippi. They lived together, they had kids, and they're buried next to each other.
Okay, so let's get back to your great-great-grandmother.
Okay. So
you assume it was not a consensual relationship, but she managed to own her own home 5 years after being freed from slavery.
For which she paid cash. So you don't.
How do you do that?
Because of this white man. You don't get $1,400 by saving your nickels and dimes as a slave, right?
Yeah.
So obviously somebody gave her that money. She paid cash for that house in what was largely a white neighborhood. And our family, my cousin Johnny Gates, still owns that house to this day. It was just put on
That's
the historic
amazing.
Register in Maryland. Isn't that a cool thing? But I saw that photograph and read her obituary on the day that we buried my father's father, Edward St. Lawrence Gates. And the obituary said, died this day in Cumberland, Maryland, January 6, 1888. Aunt Jane Gates, an estimable colored woman. And that night, and then Daddy showed my brother and me, Dr. Paul Gates, now Chief of Dentistry at Bronx Lebanon Hospital.
Very impressive.
Yeah. Well, it's the spirit of my mother. I could have won the Nobel Prize. And somebody said, congratulations. My mother would say, tell him about your brother who's a dentist. I go, yeah, I got a brother who's a dentist, you know, okay? So we went, my father showed us that picture and that obituary, and we went home. And the last thing I did before I went to bed was, we always had a desk in our bedrooms and had a bookcase. And on my desk sat a red Webster's Dictionary. Kids don't even know what they are anymore, but everybody here does. And the last thing I did before I went to bed on July 2nd, 1960, was to look up the word estimable. And that imprinted this woman's story in my mind. And the only reason that I started making the series that became Finding Your Roots is because of that obituary and that photograph. So I'm telling the story over and over of rediscovering my own lost roots. And the geneticists have found the identity, finally, of Jane Gates's paramour. The man...
Oh, really?
Yes. My great-great-grandfather's now been found.
And who is he?
We know he was Irish from my DNA. I have the O'Neill haplotype. You get your Y DNA from your father, and that's what makes me a man, and you don't have a Y DNA, so that's why you're a woman. And my Y DNA, which is comes in an unbroken chain, descends from this Irishman. So we knew he was Irish. Yeah.
Okay, on your mother's side, you found out that you had three men in the family who were freed slaves, freed before 1776, and they fought in the Revolutionary War. And consequently, you are now a member of the Sons of the American Revolution.
Yeah, isn't that a hoot?
It's amazing.
And, you know, what's even more amazing, it's one, it was my mother's third great grandfather, my fourth great grandfather, his name was John Redmond, and he fought for the Continental Army. He was a free Negro, as we would have said then. And he mustered in Winchester, Virginia on Christmas Day, 1778, and was mustered out of the Continental Army in April of 1784. It's the damnedest thing I ever heard. And what's the real showstopper for me is the fact that my three sets of my fourth great grandparents lived 18 miles from where I was born. I don't think that's true for very many people in this room or many people who are watching this show. It's incredible that the mystery to my family tree, I'm looking toward Africa, and it was 18 miles away in Moorefield, West Virginia County Courthouse. That's incredible.
Really,
it's really
yeah.
interesting.
But when I think about your ancestors fighting in the Revolutionary War, and then...
Just one, John
Just
Redmond.
One, okay.
Yeah.
And then your slightly more contemporary ancestors not having any rights in the country, mm-hmm. you know, or very few rights, not being able to vote, having to live in this in segregation.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, when you think about American history...
It's mind-boggling.
It's mind-boggling. I mean, like I'm second generation American.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, and when my grandparents came as immigrants, my family was able to assimilate pretty easily because we're white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and your family was one of them anyways, was in the Revolutionary
but just,
War.
And think about it. But you're absolutely right. Even if you were free and you were black,
yeah.
in most states, you weren't allowed to vote. And some states, like New York, would let them vote sometime and then take it away, and then it was a property requirement. It was a horrible, horrible thing. It was better to be free than be a slave, but you were free, but not free.
Okay, so you found out that your ancestors were like 18 miles away from where you live,
yeah.
but you also wanted to know who are your African ancestors.
Yeah.
So when you had your DNA done, did you have a wish for a certain area of Africa or a certain group of African people who you wanted to be your ancestors?
Yeah, no one's ever asked me that, but the answer is yes. Because I studied with a person who has been on your show, Wole Soyinka, the Nigerian playwright, when I went to the University of Cambridge. He was there in exile because he had been imprisoned in the Biafran Civil War for 27 months and was given a fellowship at the University of Cambridge. And I showed up from Yale, and he became my mentor. And so he introduced me to the Yoruba people. You know, we say tribe, but now this is not politically correct. So the Yoruba ethnic group in Western Nigeria. And I wanted to be from them. But when I started the series, it wasn't called Finding Your Roots. You remember, it was called African American Lives. I only did black people.
Yeah.
I started with Oprah and Quincy Jones and Bishop T.D. Jakes and Chris Tucker. And the DNA test we were doing at that time, when they analyzed my Y DNA, it went to Ireland. And when they analyzed my mitochondrial DNA, it went to England. I am descended from, on my father's side, from a white man who impregnated a black woman, and on my mother's side, from a white woman who was impregnated by a black man. So if you were a Martian and came down and looked at my DNA results, you'd think I was a white boy, you know? And then when they did my admixture, I'm 50% Sub-Saharan African and 50% European, and virtually no Native American ancestry, which really pisses my family off.
So you're not Yoruba.
But then they did another special test. And I cluster more toward the Yoruba than any, because 50%
wow, okay.
of my ancestry is from Sub-Saharan Africa. But it's just not those two genetic lines.
So given this kind of really rich mix that you've just described and all the surprises that you've just described, what does race mean to you? What is race? Does race exist?
No, race is a social construction. But mutations exist. Biology matters. When my daughters were born, I had them tested for sickle cell because black people are not the only people in the world that have sickle cell, but we have a disproportionately higher risk of sickle cell. You might have prostate cancer that runs in your family. You might have breast cancer. We know that BRCA1 and BRCA2, they're genetic. And if you're Ashkenazi Jewish, you might have a higher risk for those kind of things. Or Tay-Sachs. You can say on the one hand that race is a social construction, but on the other hand, you can't say the biology doesn't matter because it does matter. So I just wrote an essay that was published by Yale University Press about race. The title is, Race is a Social Construction, but Mutations are Real.
Have you been medically DNA tested?
Huh?
Do you want to know your medical DNA?
Oh, my father and I were the first father and son of any race, and the first African Americans fully sequenced. In 2009, when I did Faces of America, a retail value of full genomic sequencing was $300,000.
Wow.
And because it was PBS, we negotiated a deal with this company, Illumina, which sequences everybody. For $50,000, they sequenced my father, me, and then 12 of the guests who were in Faces of America. Not a full genome, but a dense genotyping. So that was a steal. Now you can get a full sequence for less than $5,000. Some people say $1,000 or $2,000. That's how much the science of genetics has changed in terms of the retail market since 2009. It's incredible.
So you know your medical background and if you're...
Yeah, well, I'll tell you a funny story. I told him that I did not want to know if I had any of the sort of, I don't know, the slam dunk genes for Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
And they said, okay, we won't tell you. And so then they came in, and this was a big deal back in 2009. We filmed the whole thing. They had two geneticists. They had a medical doctor who specializes in sharing this information. And another person to interpret my genetic data because there's 6 billion base pairs, right? It's a lot of data to process. And I sat down, we started to roll, and the first thing they said was, you don't have any of the genes that's going to give you Alzheimer's. I said, thank God. And my father lived to be 97 and a half without any dementia. So I thought that I had a pretty good chance. So what I did, my father and I agreed for science that we put our genomes in the public domain so that any scholar or student can study our genome. So I'm out there. You know, I'm totally exposed. Right. You know, it's the way it is.
So having done your, like, ancestry and everything, were you close to your parents?
Was I close to them?
Yeah.
Very close to them, yeah, particularly to my mother. When I was a boy, I was closer to my mother than my father. When I became a teenager, my father and I bonded. My father loved sports, and I didn't care about sports that much. I was more of a bookworm.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a young teenager, early adolescence, my father and I connected through the news. He loved the news, and I loved the news. And my brother went off to dental school, so it was just the two of us and my mom, right? That was one of the happiest days of my life when my brother went to dental school. He wasn't even out the door, and I moved into his bedroom. I go, goodbye, I hope you never come back. You know, like, maybe for Christmas, okay. So then I became close to them, but in two completely different ways.
Your father died not too long ago, like a few years ago. Mm-hmm. He was 97, as you said.
Yeah.
Because you knew so much about your family history, and because the day you got interested in your family history was the day your grandfather died.
Right.
Was that reflected in the way you wanted to say goodbye to your father at the funeral?
Yeah, you know, I try to doing Finding Your Roots is a way to paying homage to my mother and father every year. Remember, it's my father dragged my brother and me upstairs in his parents' home and made us wait while he looked through half a dozen of his father's scrapbooks about which we knew nothing, complete mystery, a secret to us, looking for that obituary. And it's for my father. It's a gift. And for my mom. And it turned out, my father used to say, you know, your mother's family is really distinguished too. And I couldn't imagine what, but two sets of those fourth great grandparents are from my mother's line. And my mother used to write the eulogies, the obituaries for all the black people in the Potomac Valley where I grew up. And they would be published in the newspaper, and then when you were buried, she would stand up, the minister would call on her, and she would stand up and read their obituary, their eulogy. And before I started school, I started school when I was, well, five, turning six, I would get dressed up and I would go to church with my mom, and I would watch this beautiful, brilliant goddess. My mother was a seamstress, as you know, and your father was a tailor, which is why we
like
each
other. My grandfather. Yeah.
Your grandfather.
Yeah.
And my mother went to Atlantic City, and we have her have a wall of degrees at home, and I have my mother's certificate from this vocational school where she learned to be a seamstress. And she was a beautiful woman. And I realized only recently that though I was raised to be a doctor, deep down, I really wanted to be a writer. And the reason I wanted to be a writer is that my mother wrote so beautifully and read so beautifully. So my whole life is really an attempt to honor and please my parents and make them proud of me, you know, and I hope they are.
But it's making me think of how much death figured into your formative thoughts. The death of your grandfather, which led you to see the picture of your great-great-grandmother. Mm-hmm. Everybody's deaths to your mother memorialized in those obituaries.
So you're saying I should have been an undertaker.
Yeah, that was my next question. Yeah.
But I have an announcement to make for you in front of all these people and all these viewers. I'm here to ask on behalf of our production staff, if you will be a guest in next season of Finding Your Roots. Yeah, would you do it?
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. She can't even talk.
I can't.
Terry grows speechless. First time in 35 years.
I regret we are out of time.
Okay, I can do it. This is fresh air.
It has been a great honor to speak with you. Thank you so much for accepting this award. And
thank you.
Thank you for all the things you've written, for your TV shows, for your movies. Thank you for being you.
Thank you, darling. Thank you. Thank you. Salt and pepper.
Terry Gross interviewed Henry Louis Gates last May when he was in Philadelphia to accept the WHYY Lifelong Learning Award. Gates is the host of the TV genealogy series Finding Your Roots. Terry will be one of the guests whose family history is explored next year in the sixth season of the show. The fifth season of Finding Your Roots is currently showing on PBS. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer this week is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.